So what is the secret to happiness? Well, it turns out science still doesn't know. Dave Myers teaches psychology at Hope College. He says there's a growing body of research in happiness studies, which is chipping away at one of life's greatest riddles. What makes for a happy life? He says some of the newest research tells us humans are hopelessly inept at something called forecasting, the ability to predict our future happiness.
We have great difficulty forecasting our happiness. When people think about how they'd be affected by good things like warmer winters, a football victory, maybe losing weight, more television channels, they overestimate the extent to which their positive emotions will endure. And likewise, if something bad happens, even very bad, you don't get tenure or you suffer a significant disability, the bad effects of that are shorter lived than most people expect. Emotions have a shorter half-life than most people predict. And my colleagues Dan Gilbert and Tim Wilson have referred to this as the durability bias. We tend to think emotions are more durable than they really are.
How do you study this? Can you give me an example of the way in which you would test it?
Well, for example, people coming up for tenure have been asked how enduringly significant it would be to them if they do or don't get tenure. Or people who are about to receive the outcome of an HIV test are asked to predict what their emotions will be. And then if you go back to people who some years before did or did not receive tenure to find out whether indeed, as people predict, those who did not receive tenure were lastingly devastated, you find that, surprisingly, the people who didn't get tenure and those who did are doing about equally well emotionally. And likewise, people who've been struck by some physical tragedy, even being declared HIV positive, find that although they're distraught for a while, emotions tend to rebound sooner than you might predict. Weeping may tarry for the night, but joy comes in the morning, reflected the psalmist. And by the way, that's kind of reassuring news for people like myself. I live with progressive hearing loss. I'm on a trajectory toward the complete deafness that marked my mother's life. And so I take some reassurance from these studies that show that even people struck by disabilities manage to adapt, and emotions tend to rebound.
Things aren't going to be nearly as bad as we thought. Is that true across the board? These situations you've described tend to be, they look anyway, like big things in your life.
Yeah.
There seems to be some similarity to research I've seen in the past that suggests, you know, I'll be happy if I buy that red tie. I'll be happy if my kid gets Tickle Me Elmo for Christmas. None of which generally proves
right
to be true.
Yes, if only, you know, we get what we're longing or lusting for, then we will be happy. Usually, we're living with an illusion. And in fact, getting a raise does make people happier, but not for long. Again, that's the durability bias. Even, by the way, people who've lived through the Holocaust have turned out to be, at least the American immigrants who were Holocaust survivors, to be an amazingly resilient and healthy and thriving group. That's not to say that there's nothing so terrible that would have no lasting effect. Rape survivors, for example, live enduringly with the after effects of that trauma and are haunted by that, by the haunting memories of that trauma. But by and large, we cope very well. We are a very adaptive species.
Is this counterintuitive in some ways? In looking through some of the examples in your research or research on the subject, I came across things like, oh, somebody was asked, would you rather have a trick knee or a broken leg, for instance? And people said, oh, I'd rather have a trick knee because a broken leg would be so painful.
Right. But a broken leg, one gets over, and a trick knee may go on and on and on. It may become part of that nagging pain that's part of everyday life. I think it is surprising because people are not very accurate at predicting their emotions. And it's also rather surprising to many people that the very good thing over time of increased affluence and all the technology and comfort that it buys has had no effect on the well-being of Americans or Western Europeans, for example. We today have more than twice the personal disposable, that's after-tax income, of people 40 and 45 years ago. We have all the technology. We have air conditioning in our homes, which they didn't have. We have email and post-it notes and garage door openers and phone answering machines. I love it. I wouldn't want to be without any of it. And yet, people are no happier today than they were 40 years ago. In fact, if anything, they're slightly more likely to be depressed. Our teens are more likely to commit suicide. So the rising economic tide has definitely not lifted us emotionally.
Intuitively, I would suggest to you that there must be some level at which that problem begins. Below that level, a little money would make an awful lot of difference. The money
yes.
to have a house and a roof
yes.
over your head, enough
yes.
to eat, clothes to wear.
And when you get that, you also get a certain measure of control over your life. And that is a predictor of happiness. People who feel in control of their lives live with greater happiness than people who feel like their lives are out of control. So there is a modest correlation between income and happiness, but only up to a point. And we've seen this in data from Australia as well, too. When you go from the bottom tenth to about the third tenth or decile of income, there's some increase in happiness, but you get diminishing returns after that.
You know, one of the things this seemed to suggest is that we tend to intellectually define happiness as coming in big leaps and bounds. But in fact, we live pretty much once you get to a certain level, it's not the big changes that make a difference, it's the little ones.
Right. And then the other things come into play. Assuming you have some control over your life and you have enough to meet life's basic necessities, such as close, supportive, enduring, committed relationships. People who have intimate soulmate friends are happier than people who don't. 40% of married Americans over the last quarter century have reported themselves very happy in repeated surveys by the National Opinion Research Center, as have only 22% of never married Americans, marriage being an example of a close, enduring partnership for many people. So, what we call social support or close relationships, that's a big predictor of happiness among two or three such predictors.
Do most Americans think they are happy?
Interestingly, most books about happiness will tell you that few people are genuinely happy. These books, however, are mostly written by mental health workers who spend their days with deeply unhappy people. If
yes.
you go, in fact, to the average American or random samples of Americans, you find that 6 in 10 say they're pretty happy. 3 in 10 say they're very happy. Only 1 in 10 say they're not very happy. Most people are reasonably happy, and it's the occasionally miserable ones. And for all of us, misery strikes us occasionally, but that's not the normal human condition.
It's funny looking at it, isn't it? I mean, if you watch television, you see that there is more and more advertising done for antidepressants. In fact, people seem to talk more and more about being depressed, and we see indications that many people are being medicated for depression. That would suggest that people are less happy.
But that could be true. That is, it could be simultaneously true that there's somewhat more depressed people today than there was a half century ago, despite increased affluence, as we noted earlier. And yet, that's still a small percentage. And it is still the case today, as it was a half century ago, that overwhelmingly people, 9 in 10 people, describe themselves as pretty or very happy.
Dave Myers teaches psychology at Hope College.